broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of the Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen, joined in our local studio by Brett Dickinson.
Just the two of us. We've been left to our own devices again, hey?
Yeah, that's right.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. And apologies for the husky voice, or maybe not apologies.
That sounds good to me.
Doesn't it? Yeah. Especially with quality microphone and quality headphones.
Hopefully the listeners enjoy it.
I could change the topic of this week's podcast to...
Oh, Louis, where are you going here?
Sultry stories.
I can't give a straight face. I don't know if I want to participate in that.
Welcome to Midnight Stories.
I'm your host.
Let's move on. My goodness, let's move on.
It's not what we're about here.
All right, no, it's not. Everything's above the table here.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Good week.
Oh, yeah, pretty good week.
Did your voice change there?
It did. It's croaky and it's squealy. It's all those things. Just looking at investment markets in Joel's absence, it's been a week of consolidation. The week before this week, some significant falls happened immediately once the yield curve inverted, which for our regular listeners would know that is a sign. It's not the only sign, but it's one of a series of signs that we look for before a potential market downturn. Mm-hmm. So it can be a signal that we're coming towards the end of a longer cycle, but that we could still have potentially more than a year to go, and a year of profits and good share market returns in front of us.
Yep.
So this week, not a huge amount of share market movement compared to last week.
Okay.
Not really too much to report on there.
Well,
what else has been happening?
I heard of a bad investment in the news this morning.
Did you? What was that?
This is the spectators that bought tickets to the Boomers versus the Team USA basketball that's in Melbourne at the moment.
Oh, really?
You haven't heard the update? Oh, apparently
no,
there's
what
uproar
happened
this morning. So on the news this morning, they really pushed it that... obviously, a big game. People have, as soon as they've heard the US basketball teams coming out to play against the Boomers,
yep,
any avid basketball fans, especially that follow the NBA and seeing that there's going to be a star-studded team from the US, have, you know, put out hundreds and in some cases over $1,000 for tickets.
Whoa.
First disappointment is that the team that you would hope to come from the USA wasn't as star-studded as they expected. I mean, still very good because of the depth of the NBA, but not the big names that they were hoping to get.
Yep.
And obviously, a couple of the Australian stars didn't show up, so there's a negative already. But you'd still go to the game, you know, high expectations.
Yep.
Only to get there and realise for those that have paid the highest ticket price, which is circa $1,500, so
whoa,
not cheap for a few hours entertainment, they hosted it at Marvel Stadium, so a football stadium.
Okay.
Not designed for basketball.
No, not at all.
So how do you get, you know, a basketball, a ground, like the floorboards and everything underneath it, onto a football stadium and then arrange the seating? So the only way they could do it is to put the court in the middle of the stadium or the field on a raised platform.
Oh.
So the people that have paid the most are then sitting on $5 plastic chairs looking up at the court.
Oh, my goodness.
So how do you watch basketball? You know, you look at a typical basketball arena, everyone's raised above the court or level with it.
Yep.
Here you are, you're paying the premium and you're below the court trying to look up.
Jeez.
You could barely take it all in. So,
yeah,
I can understand the uproar. And,
wow.
One person in particular got a lot of media attention because he was there calling it out was, of course, Russell Crowe.
Oh, right.
Probably the biggest name there that really bagged it. So a few disappointed people, I think.
I bet.
In fact, he said here's a tip for you. He said if you've got a ticket to the second game, go and get your refund now, watch it on TV and buy your kids a jersey. Better investment.
So, good one,
anyway,
Rusty.
Disappointing story. So that could have been a you can't be serious, but anyway.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Oh, well, there's a bit of financial advice from Russell Crowe.
Yes.
Thanks. All right. Well, look, getting into today's episode, I might kick over to you first, Brett.
Yep.
For what's news in the property world.
Well, I want to follow on from the conversation we had last week about the article I referenced calling that there's been the bubonic plague, referencing a lot of the inferior apartments built over the last 20 years Australia.
Yeah, and your big point was that a building that was made, that was developed in the 80s or 90s or 2000s.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Is not the quality of apartments that were being built even 100 years ago. You've got 100-year-old buildings that are still standing without structural issues or defects, yet you've got these 20-year-old buildings or 10-year-old buildings that have major defects with cladding and standards and even things like soundproofing and the livability factors.
All of that. And it's a general statement because there will be good and bad buildings, but I guess the issue in when there's enough of them, and there's a lot of people that are suffering from this because of the financial impact, if you're one of these purchasers, it becomes newsworthy. And a few of the major news outlets pick it up, and they, you know, they start to really dig deeper.
Yeah.
So Four Corners actually did a whole episode on it on Monday night.
Oh, really?
And they focused on a couple of the Sydney buildings that had had these issues and what it meant for the purchasers and the owners of that building. And this is they focused on one in particular, which was the Mascot Towers that were built seven or eight years ago.
Yes.
And how owners have had to vacate because of the structural damage and everything else. And not only were they not able to do anything and sell their properties within this time frame, they weren't even able to occupy them.
That's right.
So the cost of living and so it really, you know, puts their life in turmoil to some degree.
Yep.
And now they're starting to get to the realization of what it's going to cost them just to rectify the building, and it's going to have to come out of all of the owners.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. Wow. So not ideal. And then I see, so obviously Four Corners were painting a really bad picture there.
Mm.
Then I see an article this morning going into a little bit more detail that says the construction crisis is to cost $6.2 billion in repairs.
What?
Yeah. So I don't know exactly how they got to the figure, but it's mainly focused around... So the report says over 3,400 apartment buildings across Australia had defective, non-compliant combustible cladding installed require remediation work to make the building safe. Now, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to review the whole article to see, is that $6.2 billion just on the combustible cladding remediation, or is it also the structural defects that have been identified in a lot of these other buildings?
Yeah.
So, look, it's really putting the construction industry in a bad light, and it's a wake-up call to a lot of the industry participants, but also to purchasers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, from the majority of our listeners, unless they're active in the industry, they're at some point going to be looking at a property and making a decision about whether to buy it.
Yep.
So I thought it was worth having a bit of a catch-up on, if you are going to buy a property, obviously an existing property that may have issues, you're going to be able to get the information before you buy. You know, you can walk through it, you can do research, you can look at any of the owner's corporation information, the history of the building, get a building and pest inspection or whatever's required, and obviously have your lawyer, you know, give you whatever other information is required.
Yeah.
When you're buying off the plan, it's not so cut and dry because it doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, of course.
And because of these circumstances coming about in the last 15 to 20 years, and obviously being now only washing through where it's become, you know, a real focus in the public eye, what should you do if you're thinking of purchasing off the plan? Is it scared you off totally? Or, you know, does it still mean that there's opportunities to buy off the plan?
Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify, what we mean by buying off the plan is when you go into a contract to purchase from a developer a building that doesn't exist yet. So the developer would have the right to develop and build something on the site, and they would have ownership of the land or control of the land in such a way that they can enter into a contract to sell you whatever the completed product is on the agreed basis of the contract that you signed prior to construction.
Yep.
So there's pros and cons with buying off the plan. Now, previously buying off the plan, the biggest pro or biggest benefit of buying off the plan was typically you'd get significant stamp duty savings.
Yes.
So around the country, stamp duty is anywhere from sort of 3 to 5% typically.
Yep.
And if you think about it, if you're buying a, say, $500,000 property at around 5%, that's $20,000 to $30,000 that you're paying on top of the cost of it.
That's significant.
So, yeah, to be able to save that in a purchase makes sense to do it.
Yeah.
So that was one benefit. Now, a lot of that's changed a lot. So every state's a little bit different. So you'd need to investigate how much of a benefit that could be for you. And it's also now linked more with first home buyers versus, you know, people that are buying their second or third property. So you may not be able to get any stamp duty savings anymore. So that may not be the major benefit. The other benefits can be, though, if a market is moving, and typically over, you know, our history in Australia with residential property, appreciation and capital growth has always been fairly consistent and regular and expected. So if that's where we believe the market's going to continue to go, well, buying a property off the plan and locking in a price now means that by the time you settle, it should be worth or could be worth more than what you've agreed to pay. So you're actually finalizing your payment of the property. Of course, you've had to pay a deposit, but only a small amount, around 10% or 10% typically. But you may actually be settling on a property and only paying out the balance of that on a property that's worth more than what you've agreed to pay. So that could have been a benefit. Now, there's obviously no guarantees that's going to happen going forward. But that is a reason you may potentially buy off the plan. One of the other major reasons I think some people would buy off the plan if they're buying to live in that premise is to give them some certainty around their planning. Sometimes it's a challenge if you live in a property now and you're trying to buy one and sell your own. It can be a real juggling act. Whereas if you've got some understanding as to when you're likely to have a property to move, and you can start to plan and have a bit of time to figure out, do I want to sell my furniture? Do we want to, what sort of plan do we want to use to sell our existing property or whatever it might be? So it gives you a little bit of flexibility around getting better prepared. One of the other major benefits, if it's off the plan, by the time you get to own it, it's new. Everything's spick, span.
You know, no one's touched it before.
So it's a lovely feeling knowing something that's brand new. So they're the major reasons I think you would look to buy off the plan. Probably the only other reason I think you would look at off the plan versus existing outside of those is because it's being built in an area where there isn't a lot of availability for anything else. So that is quite different to a lot of the properties we mentioned last week, you know, that have got these issues because they're being built where they're mass produced, you know, cookie cutter type stuff where there's hundreds in each building and they're side by side. Okay, so typically...
I'll throw in another benefit as well, which is the depreciation benefits, the tax
for
benefits.
Investment, yeah, absolutely.
If you're an investor, then you get the a higher amount of tax deductions when you buy off the plan.
Definitely, So there are still valid reasons to consider off the plan, okay? But because of what's come to light recently of, you know, buildings being actually delivered in a state that's not what was paid for or expected... It's a matter of, okay, if I'm going to buy off the plan, how do I guard against that now? So that can be a challenge. Now, there's not an absolute way to guard against everything because, you know, risks happen and there's so many variables. But what I think will happen, especially now in light of a lot of this coming to the attention of the regulators and other people looking at the industry, is the standards are going to have to lift. Because a lot of the builders that have delivered these products probably won't get any more work. Or they're, you know, they're being hit with damages and remediation costs, depending on how it all plays out. So the standards are going to have to lift, and the industry as a whole is starting to put more regulation around how a lot of the certifications that validate a building is ready for occupancy comes about. So I think, first of all, anyone looking to buy off the plan needs to be aware that it is going to get better. That process is going to go, well, it has to. Because the industry is probably still the biggest employer in the country. So obviously there's a lot of participants and a lot of stakeholders that want to see it continue. So they have to make sure they protect the consumer and give them something that's going to give them comfort to continue to purchase. So it will get better. The other things you can do, of course, having a good lawyer slash conveyancer review the contract. But the things that the lawyer may not be able to do that you may need to do is research the developer and the builder a little bit more, or at least the process they're going to use for getting you to a certificate of occupancy and what your rights are in terms of looking at defects and how that will play out. So you can... the contract that you enter into when you purchase off the plan specifies you know, what's supposed to be delivered. Now, if you get to the end point and the property's built and then the developer comes and says, right, now pay me the balance, you have a right to an inspection. You can bring an independent inspector and you get to review all the defects. Now, if that's not up to scratch, you don't have to settle. Doesn't mean you don't have to settle if it's rectified. It just means you don't have to settle until it's rectified. You know, you're still obliged to buy as long as they rectify everything to the level that they agree to in the contract.
So you're obliged to buy, but they're obliged to deliver the product that you have purchased.
as outlined in the contract and at a level, you know, that is expected.
Okay.
So there's still plenty of reasons why off the plan can work and will work. Whether it's the right decision for you, though, may come down to, first of all, those benefits. And if it's for investment purposes, obviously location and type of dwelling. We haven't even mentioned whether it's a large. And when I, one other thing. When it's off the plan, that doesn't necessarily only mean apartments. Okay, now, pretty much everything we've spoken about has been apartments. Okay, but you can buy off the plan house and land packages.
That's true. Okay. Absolutely.
And that may be a, you know, a reasonable investment if it's in a good location and there's a lot of infrastructure or growth factors coming to that area. Okay. And even townhouses can be bought off the plan. Okay. So the majority of the negative publicity about these buildings and the I guess the anti off the plan sentiment is mainly around apartments. Okay. So off the plan exists for all of those three types of dwellings. Okay. So definitely, you know, keep an eye on it and be understanding of what the process is to buy off the plan, but don't eliminate it purely because of what the media is saying and the publicity.
Look, I think the publicity and the uproar is well justified because there's some absolute duds where the buildings just aren't up to standard and there's a major consumer protection issue there.
And unfortunately, it wasn't in place for those consumers when they bought. So it's changing.
So, but like any issue when you're dealing with an entire industry, these are the worst out of a lot of developments that have been built over the last 10 and 20 years. So there is a lot of quality that is out there as well.
And of course, anytime the media wants to publicize or really, you know, get eyeballs and clicks, you know, they have to put a headline out there and go to the extreme with what they're talking about. So of course, a lot of what's being publicized and put into the, you know, the public eye for attention is the worst scenarios, all the really bad parts.
And I can show you bad examples of anything.
Of course.
You know, dodgy plumbers versus great plumbers. Dodgy gyms versus great gyms. Dodgy apartments versus great apartments.
Every industry would have it.
That's right, exactly. So it's good to have some things to keep in mind when you are looking at it to make sure that you're not getting a dodgy one and you're getting a good one. I like the one where you talk about the track record of the people involved. Because I think I think the career of the people involved in the project is a very important consideration. If you've got people who are doing the project that have done projects before that are quality, well, then you've got good people who are going to be severely disadvantaged for their next property development. When they do their next one, well, they want to still have a good reputation in the industry for delivering on good quality products. I wonder how much work the builders and developers are getting who built these dodgy ones.
Look, I haven't got any information to really validate that at the moment.
No, but their reputation is going to be stained.
And look, from the Four Corners episode, the developer that was responsible, for, I believe it was for the Mascot Towers, I would assume he's he hasn't done anything since. And they did try to approach him and he slammed the door in their face. Now, whether the hard part also from a developer's perspective, let's, we'll just go off on a tangent here. If you are buying off the plan, it's important to understand that the developer and the builder are separate entities the majority of the time. Sometimes a builder may want to do a development themselves because they know they can build it, you know, and maybe get efficiencies. But typically, a developer is the person that decides to buy the land and get the approvals, do all the sales and marketing, and engages the builder. So there are separate companies. So the majority of the issues we're talking about are really a result of the builder. Now, obviously, the developer is accountable to some degree because they engage the builder on suitable terms. And look, one of the, I probably forgot to mention this, but if anyone does get a chance to watch the Four Corners show, one of the key reasons they thought a lot of this was happening was not just faulty workmanship on behalf of the builder, but developers cost cutting where they were getting an architect to help them get the approval to develop and getting a very credible, maybe even a big name architect that they could then use for branding and marketing to achieve the sales, the pre-sales off the plan. But then removing that architect and engaging the builder and some I guess, inferior quality consultants and subcontractors to do the design work.
Oh, very interesting.
So what happens when a builder is engaged, they have a really detailed set of documents explaining how everything needs to be done and how well it's engineered.
Yep.
Now, architects hang their hat on, you know, not only being able to design nice buildings that make sense and are functional, but being able to produce those drawings in detail so that the builder knows how to put everything together in a way that's going to make it a sound building.
Yeah.
So if the developer decides to cut costs and remove that quality architect and engage draftsmen or a builder that may be looking to cut costs themselves, if a builder wants to do the design work of those drawings, they might... you know, have people in-house or that aren't as good at it and are looking for how they can do the cheaper quality build so that the builder makes more money but doesn't deliver the same outcome. That could be an area when you're looking to buy off the plan if it is an apartment building. Now, houses are subtly different because they're generally the builders have got a standard approach and it's usually a systemized type
bit
thing.
More. Yep.
But when it's an apartment building, it may pay to ask, you know, who is doing the working drawings for this? How is the architect involved in the implementation of the construction?
So the way it was explained to me is that you've got three main parties. You've got the property developer, who is best described as whoever owns that land right now and whoever's going to be selling the final product.
Yes.
So the developer is sort of is firstly the owner, but secondly the ideas person. And kind of the visionary. They've got an idea for what they want it to be.
Yep, that makes sense.
They then engage an architect who takes a broad vision and produces real images, real plans, creates real functional design, handles the town planning requirements of getting an approval from a particular council.
Yes.
So the architect is the second party, and then the third party is the builder. And the builder has to take the architect's plans and then actually physically build it.
Correct.
Yep. So all three of those parties need to be involved. Mm-hmm. And I think where and what you're saying is the track record in the building quality comes down to the builder has to build a quality product, but the architect also has to have quality plans to provide to the builder.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. So we're a build because if I'm in business and I can, you know, if you agree to buy something for me at an agreed price and I think, hey, the specification of what you've agreed to buy is a little bit loose, I could substitute a cheaper alternative in there but still meet my obligation to you.
Yep.
I would probably do that to make more profit.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of builders may do things. They might say, oh, well, we can still get the outcome that was specified in our agreement to build, but I can do it cheaper by doing it this way.
Yeah, I see.
And that's where sometimes the builder might be the one cutting costs.
Mm.
So it's not the developer's it's the developer's responsibility because ultimately they're the ones selling the product to you.
Yep.
But it may be the builder that hasn't necessarily gone about things appropriately.
Yeah.
But then again, the developer needs to hold the builder to account and understand this process.
That's right.
So they are tied together in that way.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Very interesting. Mm. Well, thank you, Brett. Very insightful, very educational.
Yeah.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, listeners. Joining us from our remote studio today is Joel Hewish with an update on what's happening in the world and share markets.
Well, hello, guys, and welcome from the US. On the west coast of the US, I am at the moment, currently in Seattle, and keeping a close eye on how the markets are tracking at this stage. It's been a couple of weeks since I've given a market update. Nevertheless, even while I am traveling, I'm still keeping a very keen eye on the markets. And I thought today what we might do is address some of the concerns that have been raised over the past week and a half or so with the inversion of the yield curve. Now, there's been a lot of news that has been a lot of discussion in the news around the inverted yield curve in the US Treasury bond market. But what does it mean? Well, an inversion of the yield curve, and the one that is most important, that most market pundits tend to follow, is the US 2-year Treasury bond rate. So that's the interest rate that the US government borrows money from investors, and comparing that to the 10-year US Treasury bond market. And that is the rate that the US government can borrow from 10 years at 10 years from investors. Now, the theory goes, and the way that normal financial market and risk-taking should actually play out and the pricing of these different interest rate investments should be that in the short term, interest rates should be cheaper, and in the longer term, interest rates should be higher. So when we have an inversion, what that basically means is that long-term interest rates are actually cheaper than short-term interest rates. Now, let's have a think about why short-term interest rates should be lower than long-term interest rates. Well, in a normal yield curve environment where financial markets are operating normally and risk-taking is being priced appropriately, what tends to happen and what should actually happen is that short-term interest rates should be priced at a cheaper price than long-term interest rates. And why is that the case? Well, theoretically, you should get a risk premium for lending money longer to a government, an individual, corporation, whatever it may be. You should get a premium for the longer that you lend that money to a particular borrower. Why is that? Well, you've got time risk. A lot more things can go wrong over 10 years than what can go wrong over 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, even 2 years. So in order to encourage lenders to lend more at longer terms, there should be a risk premium built into that interest rate, which will entice lenders to lend 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, like with a normal 30-year mortgage rate. So when you think about it and you have a look at what the local banks are, be that any of the major banks here in Australia or overseas, you'll always find that a short-term deposit will be priced at a much cheaper interest rate than a long-term mortgage. Why is that? Because in a normal functioning environment, normal functioning financial system, banks borrow from us as depositors on the short term. So they'll borrow from us at 30 days, 90 days, 12 months, 5 years, whatever it may be. And then they lend that money that they borrow from us out at 30-year mortgage rates. And if the interest rate differential between what they collect in interest and mortgage repayments, on interest on mortgage repayments, is higher than what they are paying out to us as short-term depositors, then they make a profit. Now, though, the concern is with the inversion of the yield curve, which is what has taken place recently in the US Treasury bond market, is that with interest rates having now inverted and short-term interest rates, in particular the 2-year Treasury bond rate versus the 10-year Treasury bond rate in the US, with the 2-year being now more expensive than the 10-year, that's often a sign that financial conditions are being tightened by central banks to the point that they're trying to actually be restrictive with monetary policy, and often it has been a precursor to a recession in the United States. Now, the 10-year US Treasury bond is the prime rate for which all other interest rates around the world are set. The US is still the dominant power in the financial system. It is still the deepest, most liquid debt market in the world. And when banks around the world are trying to figure out how much they're going to charge on their 30-year and 20-year and 10-year loans, they always use the US 10-year Treasury bond rate, which is a proxy for the world's risk-free rate of return. Okay, so therefore, when they then price their mortgage rates, they're looking at what's the risk-free rate of return or risk-free interest rate in the world, and where should we be pricing this particular loan to this particular borrower with this particular credentials? Where should we be pricing this particular loan that we're going to make to them, taking into account the credit risk that they represent? And that is therefore the margin that they would charge above what the US risk-free treasury bond rate is, which is the US 10-year treasury bond yield. Now, with the inversion of the yield curve, this has raised a number of concerns. Why? Well, the reality is that post-war, the US has, every time it's gone into recession, the US 2 and 10-year yield curves have inverted in every instance prior to the US going into recession. And this is what's got a lot of market watchers concerned, a lot of analysts concerned. And so what I wanted to do today is just address some of the facts around an inversion of the US 2 and 10-year Treasury bond yield and what it actually means. And the reality is that it is not actually black and white as the media would have you believe. In actual fact, selling your shares at the time the US 2-year becomes more expensive than the US 10-year Treasury bond has been a horrible decision. In actual fact, in the last five instances that the US 2-year has traded higher than the US 10-year interest rate, you would have missed out on average on a 21.8% return after the 2-year Treasury bond had inverted. And in most instances, in actual fact, on average, over the last five instances, the average time delay from when the 2-year Treasury bond yield inverted to a peak in the US stock market had been 19.3 months. So not only from the time that the US Treasury bond yield inverts has it been a bad investment decision, potentially giving up 21.8% if you had have sold at the time that this occurred, but you would have been out of the market 19 months on average, or 19.3 months on average, before the peak in the stock market. That means that you're looking at almost a year and a half before you really need to get concerned about a peak in the stock market and a potential future recession and significant bear market. Now, what we also want to address, or what I'd also like to address, is that things actually aren't as bad as what you might be led to believe in the papers as well. In fact, what we are actually seeing is that economic growth is still relatively resilient in the US, even though we've got the China-US trade war, which has been the most recent catalyst for the weakness that we are seeing in the markets over the past 2 to 3 weeks or so. But the underlying economic conditions in the US, the most important economy in the world still, and right now the main engine of growth for the developed world, is still chugging okay. We've got unemployment in the US at 50-year lows. We've got a GDP growth rate that in the last quarter was at 2.3%, which beat estimates. We have earnings, corporate earnings. Analysts, even though we've gone through a bit of a soft or a flat spot in terms of corporate profit growth over the past 6 months or so, analysts are now ratcheting up their expectations for corporate profit growth over the next 12 months. In fact, over the last 4 months or so, we've seen the average expectation for corporate profit growth in the US go from 6% up to 8.2%. All of this is happening while we see the headlines that doom and gloom and US recession is on the cards and that an all-out bear market might be ahead of us. These are not the conditions that would usually be a precursor to a US recession happening anytime soon and a major bear market getting started. They're more conditions that would be consistent with a bit of a correction, a bit of a sideways choppy pattern. And in actual fact, the US stock market has really gone nowhere since January of 2018, and we're now into August. So that's almost, what are we looking at there? About 20 months without the US stock market actually having gone anywhere. And that's a nice sideways correction in time. We saw a bit of a dip, obviously a fairly significant dip between October and December of last year, but we've recovered well. We haven't dipped into recession. Central banks are lowering interest rates. Corporate profit expectations, having just completed the US corporate earnings season, are now actually increasing. Their expectations for corporate profit growth going into next year is actually increasing, not decreasing. And we're also seeing levels of sentiment, fear, and pessimism come back into the market And now fear and pessimism is at a level that is generally consistent with where an 8 to 10% correction, which is roughly where we are, a garden variety correction in the stock market, where these types of corrections would actually typically tend to bottom. So overall, the underlying economic backdrop is still remains favorable for equities over the short to medium term. And when I say short to medium term, I'm sort of talking 6 months to 12 months. I would, in fact, in my own account, I had a little bit of extra cash that had accumulated in my superannuation fund. And just this week, we went ahead and put all of that cash to work. So I'm buying on this dip. I'm certainly not concerned. And when I have a look at some of the technicals as well, so we've got central banks. Let's have a look at fundamentals first of all. Central banks are lowering interest rates. That's not typically what happens when a big bear market starts. You usually got central banks ratcheting up and raising interest rates. We've got economic growth, which is remaining stable and actually has strengthened over the last quarter prior to the previous quarter in the US, and has remained fairly solid here in Australia still. We've got corporate profits expected to increase. And these are estimates that are increasing on the back of the most recent earnings results, which have only just profit season, which is only just sort of coming towards a conclusion over the past week or so. So these are fresh analyst expectations that are being ratcheted up. Once again, these are not the sorts of conditions that precede a major bear market or a recession. Now, when we have a look at some of the technicals, so the strength of the market, we saw breadth at the most recent highs that were reached in the last, say, 6 weeks or so. Breadth in the U.S. stock market, the number of stocks participating, big cap, mid cap, and small cap stocks, the number of stocks participating in a rising market was confirming the price strength. We saw breadth hitting all-time highs when we look at what we call the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line. It's a measure of those advancing stocks versus those declining stocks and coming up with a measure. And that measure, which is a cumulative measure, was reaching an all-time high at the same time the US stock market was reaching an all-time high. That's a sign of strength. It's a sign that stocks broadly, on the stock market more broadly, is performing quite well. And buyers are prepared to buy and push stocks generally to those higher prices, and it's not just being led by a few large cap issues that are dragging the indexes higher. There's good breadth. Now, what we're also seeing, though, is the amount of buying strength and selling strength. Now, typically what you would see leading into a major market top is you would see the amount of selling power or the amount of selling strength as measured by the Lowry's buying power, selling power indexes. You would usually see selling the amount of sellers or the aggressiveness of sellers start to increase as we're getting to a market top. At the same time, you would see the number of issues that were hitting new highs start to decline. Well, we haven't seen that. In fact, what we've seen is selling power has actually been relatively benign. So people aren't aggressively selling their stocks. The problem has been, particularly in the last sort of 6 to 8 weeks, is that buying power has also dried up. And so what that's saying is that there's just more a lack of conviction in the stock market right now, not major concerns by either party and no major optimism either. From the buy side, but not a lot of, but no conviction in the sell side either. So all in all, we need to give this market some time. We're seasonally into some of the weaker months of the year, August, September, and October. In fact, we've still got September to get through. September is actually the worst month out of all 12 months for the U.S. stock market, and all global stock markets take their lead from the US, so it's important that we understand the seasonality that takes place around this time of the year. But we're not seeing concerns, we're not seeing major concerns, we're not seeing any signs really that this is a time to sell your shares and go to cash. In fact, I think that could be a major mistake. I think we just need to hold our nerve a little bit here, ride through the next 2 to 3 months or so. And I think as we get closer to December, November, December, we usually start to see that seasonal strength start to reappear again. My expectations is that We'll probably have a little bit more choppiness over the next 6 to 8 weeks as we get through September and October, but all things being equal, things still look pretty good for the next 12 to 18 months or so. And on that note, guys, I'm going to hand it back to you, and I look forward to checking in again next week. This time it'll probably be from San Francisco.
Thank you, Joel. Always lovely to have your input.
Living the dream.
It's nice to hear your voice, buddy.
Yeah.
Wish I could hear from you more often. Hope you're having fun over there.
Definitely.
All right. I would like to talk about something which I experienced during the week. In fact, Brett, we both experienced. In our business.
Ooh, did we?
We did. We went to a planning day.
Oh, yeah.
We did.
And
it's a planning day which is ultimately for business purposes. But the planning day that we attended, it was partly goal setting and it was partly planning future actions.
Mm.
And it's supposed to be done every 90 days in business, but it's definitely worthwhile, and I think it's worth doing every 90 days just in life.
Yeah.
So it got me thinking, well, what are my takeaways from this, and why should everyone do this sort of planning and goal setting exercise?
Okay.
If it's not every 90 days, well, then once a year is what is often described as important. And people tend to do it at New Year's,
yeah,
when the calendar flips,
yeah,
over.
Yeah, whether it's a plan or just making some resolutions,
yep,
they at least think about it.
That's right. But some people can do it every month,
yep,
and reframe what they're doing month by month. So look, whatever you do and whenever you do it, here's the outcomes that I took from the exercise of setting goals and then planning some actions from it.
Great.
So my first takeaway is when you're doing goal setting, it's an exercise. Its objective is to clarify your thinking, but nothing actually changes.
Okay.
So some people, they're a bit adverse to goal setting because they think if I set goals, then I might not achieve them. If I set goals, then I might be too ambitious or not ambitious enough.
Mm.
If I set goals, then I'm putting a lot on the line, and there's these potentially these worries and fears that come up. Look, it's just an exercise.
Yep.
Nothing actually changes, but the effect it can have is it can really clarify your thinking.
Agreed.
So that's, yep, my first takeaway. My second takeaway is that you're encouraged to be long-sighted and to be bold and ambitious.
Yeah.
So the first step is to do some goal setting for the very long term, for a sort of 5 or 10 year period of time. And it's really along the lines of, if you could reinvent yourself and if you can reinvent your entire circumstances, then how would you make your life look?
So this is the magic wand scenario.
It's the magic wand scenario. Yeah. That's right. So let's start from scratch. What are the things that you enjoy? What are the things that you have that you're strong at and that you're good at and talented at? What are the things that bring you fulfillment? What are the things that bring you happiness? What would be all the nice things to have? Material possessions. What are the experiences that you'd like to have? What is the security that you would like to have? My next tip is it's got to cover all areas. Yeah. So it's got to cover your money, your career, your lifestyle, family and relationships, your health, hobbies, charity, personal development. All of these things go into it as well.
There's a lot happening in life.
That's right. There is a lot happening in life. So tip number one is nothing actually changes. This is just to clarify your thinking. Tip number two is to be long-sighted and to be bold and ambitious. So how would you reinvent yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Tip number three is to cover all areas.
Okay.
Once you've done these things, you've now got your brain thinking of, wow, if in 5 years' time, if I could be completely happy and healthy and rich and have all these wonderful things, that'd be pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to bring it back to a shorter time frame.
So think big, act small.
So think big, but then, bring it back to a more to a shorter time frame,
yeah,
where you can actually start seeing a comparison from where you are currently. Mm-hmm. And some people say the 3-year mark is really important, and I agree to set some 3-year goals. But I actually think the 12-month mark is really important.
Yeah, why is that?
Because 12 months is where it's the intersection of where your life is heading anyway. So for me, if I start thinking, well, if this is where I am today, I can kind of see where life is going to take me in 12 months anyway.
Yep.
But hang on, if I'm there in 12 months, is that the same direction as where I'm going in 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
And I start to see the contrast.
Yep.
So my tip number 4 is to then have a 12-month time frame and really focus in on the comparison between where you think you're going to be in 12 months and where you want to be in 5 years' time. And you start to compare the two, and you can then start to reframe things. Mm. And there's actually a lot of lessons for me in looking at where I think I'm going to be in 12 months and where I really want to be in 5 years' time.
Mm.
And I can recognize, now that I'm in this state of thinking, now that I'm doing the exercise and I have clarity in my thinking, I can actually realize, well, no, that direction is different to where I actually want my life to go.
Yeah.
And that is that really happens. Powerful.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So set some 12-month goals that are now different to where life is pushing you anyway.
Mm.
For some people, they might be stuck in a rut. For some people, they might be growing, but they might be growing in an area which is different to where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever you're at and wherever you're heading, you reframe it for, hang on, actually in 12 months, I want this to be different and I want that to be different, mm-hmm. because in the bigger picture, I want my life to be going in this grand and big direction.
Well, the time is going to pass one way or another.
That's true.
So are you going to have an impact on where it takes you or just let it take you?
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And then the final thing is to set some actions for the next 90 days.
Mm. This was what was the part, the major thing we did on the day in that planning session.
Correct, that's right.
Really get down to it.
Yep. So there is another step, which is to set your 90-day goals and then actions to achieve them. But in my mind, if you're going to do this the quick and dirty way, just go straight to actions.
Yeah.
What are the actions you're going to take right now and over the next 90 days, and where is that going to get you in 90 days?
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives you the smaller steps to do right now and makes you realize, well, hang on, I actually can change my life. I can completely reinvent certain things of what I'm doing today. Why am I doing things this way when I could actually change my circumstance? But change can be hard, so some of those actions can be quite difficult.
Louis, I've got a saying that is ringing through my mind at the moment.
What's that?
Relative to this. Simply, whatever the mind can conceive and believe, it can achieve. I heard this a long time ago, but if you break it down, it's like, well, you know, if you are looking to change or get somewhere, the first thing you've got to do is conceive where that is.
Yep.
Right? The next part of it is if you don't believe it, you'll never get there because you won't take the necessary steps.
Yep.
So sometimes in breaking it down, you start to get a clear vision. You say, oh, well, that's achievable. I believe that can happen.
Yep.
So then you can start to action it.
Yeah.
So that's just a snapshot of the way I understand this scenario.
Yeah.
We're figuring that out.
Yep. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. So if I bring it back to what this podcast is supposed to be about, which is a financial podcast, why am I talking about goal setting? Because I find that for a lot of people, people don't make changes or don't take actions on their finances because they're not making the long-term planning.
Mm.
And for a lot of people, if they actually did a financial projection on the numbers that they're currently producing from their income and their assets and reducing their debts, they're not going to achieve the financial life that they would like to in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years.
Yep.
And most people just don't compute that.
Because it is possible. Anyone can change their circumstances, improve their wealth position.
Absolutely. very small changes have a very big difference when it's over a long term.
Yes.
So there's not a huge amount that needs to be changed for a lot of people. If you've got, if you've, we generally say if you've got 15 years to retirement, we can achieve almost anything. Anyone with a 15-year time horizon has a really good chance of retiring in the next 15 years.
Yep.
Now, for someone who's 35 right now, that might sound really attractive. And I reckon you should give us a call and have a crack.
Yep.
Because...
Definitely.
If we do that and we get you to retirement when you are 50 years old, that's pretty awesome. And it doesn't have to, for a lot of people, take much sacrifice to get there.
Great.
And what's the worst that could happen? Maybe we only do it in 20 years.
Yeah, well...
Well, then you retired at 55, which is also pretty awesome.
Yep.
So so that's my key takeaway from doing this goal setting and 90-day planning exercise.
Louis, can I just add, with the how a small change now, over the long term, how much of an impact it can have, I remember having this scenario thrown at me once. It's a matter of if you're driving in a car or flying in a plane and you've got a long-haul journey, you're going a significant distance.
Yep.
If you shift the direction by like 1 degree, so yep, say 1% or whatever it is, the destination is vastly different by the time you get there.
Absolutely.
So that's the kind of scenario we're talking here. If we make a change now based on your current direction to an alternative direction, as long as we've thought it through, the outcomes in 10, 15, 20 years can be so different to what they would be if you didn't make that decision.
Yep, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, you're exactly right. If you're flying from here to London... And you don't change your course at all, if you don't touch the direction stick for the first 15 hours of the flight, then you're adding hours and hours to the end of that journey.
Yep.
But if at the start you are just lightly touching that directional controller just a little bit and you're constantly adjusting just a tiny bit, then it doesn't take much change to get you directly there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Thanks, Brett. Great analogy.
Yeah, okay.
Very good. Okay, listeners, we will be taking another break.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640. Or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back. It's now time for...
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Very good.
Where are we at today?
All right, where are we at today? Well, the first thing I'll say is that United Global Capital is hiring.
Ah.
We are looking for financial professionals.
Very
and
good.
I am serious about that. But that brings me to my first, you can't be serious. Interns, stereotypically, they have an induction by fire and they're not really valued in the workplace. A story has come out about a CEO who saw an intern wearing some Apple AirPods.
Okay.
You know, the wireless headphones in your ears.
Yep.
And he fired him on the spot.
Why?
He said, "Why are you wearing AirPods when you're an unpaid intern?"
You cannot be serious.
And the guy said, "Well, they're convenient." And the CEO said, "Well, it's pretty convenient for me to fire you right now."
Like, and that's it.
What?
Oh,
and that was
on.
It.
You
so
cannot be serious.
This guy, so the CEO, he not only did he do that, He then went onto his LinkedIn profile and told everyone what he did because, you know, he felt pretty justified in it. He felt he was being a leader. And his justification is that he's setting a benchmark for his employees and he's saying, would you show up to your new job with a nicer car than your boss? No. People, and what he says was, where is it? AirPods are reserved for my core team. Once you've proved yourself to be a valuable asset on my team, then you can wear AirPods.
Oh, wow.
How ridiculous. Can't believe it.
So this person could be a very wealthy individual that just wants to learn and work.
Could be.
And he's prejudiced against them because they've got a pair of
crazy
more expensive AirPods than he deems they should.
That's right. So my staff who are listening to this podcast, you
wear
better
your
not,
AirPods.
You better not be listening on your AirPods. Take them out now.
Is that a warning to this new employee we're trying to find? Don't show
that's
up
right.
with AirPods.
Yeah. Send me your resume, but yeah. Don't show up unless your headphones have wires.
Nice. Well, I want to bring us around to the normal level for the you can't be serious.
Yes, scenario. Go on, Brett.
Okay. Now, Louis, sometimes when animals are interacting in a way that we don't deem appropriate, one strategy is to throw water on them to get them to move away from each other, correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so a town in Wales has taken this a little bit further.
Yep.
So some new public toilets in the Welsh town of Porthcawl are designed to prevent antisocial behaviour such as vandalism and drug taking.
Right.
Right, but the big part of it is that they're planning to install public toilets that will stop sexual activity by spraying amorous occupants with water and then
what?
Silencing an alarm.
Oh, my goodness.
You cannot be serious.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah. So they're putting detection devices in these public toilets that if they sense that there's more than one person in there for an extended period of time and some extra movement, the water comes on.
Oh, jeez. Well.
So won't be visiting Wales.
No.
Or if I do, it'll be on my own.
That's right. What a great use of public funds to spend money on that. Yeah. Wow. Although there must be a lot of sex in that town.
Yeah, well, for them to be going to this extreme, they must really be worried about it.
Good on them. Mm. Very good. All right. Well, any more from you, Brett?
No, I'm done.
All right. Fantastic. Me too. Thanks for joining us, listeners. It's always a pleasure. We'll catch you again next week.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au. And follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.